You're listening to Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
Today's episode is our winter 2022 anime season reviews, part two. Didn't get all the shows that we wanted to get done, because unfortunately things have been kind of busy around here, but we do have a lot to go through still. And unfortunately, all the more popular shows are in the first to end, but there's still some good shows in this list. We have the Case Study Vanitas Part 2, which I'm really excited to talk about. How a Realist Hero Rebuilt the Kingdom Part 2, which I'm sure Chris is excited to talk about. The Genius Prince's Guide to Raising a Nation Out of Debt, which that'll be an interesting conversation. Life with an Ordinary Guy Who Reincarnated into a Totally Fantasy Knockout. She Professed Herself Pupil of the Wise Man. Love of Kill, which I still don't know what I'm thinking of that one. Offeretta, From Commonplace to World's Strongest Season 2. Princess Connect Redive Season 2, and The Strongest Sage with the Weakest Crest. Good stuff. I guess if anything, you could say like the first part of this reviews was like all a bunch of positivity, and this one can be like just weird stuff that people are just don't know anything about, and so it'll be interesting conversations at least, hopefully. But yeah, as usual, we're at talkingspirit.com. You can go there for all of our social media links and everything that you can get to support us if you wish to support us. We definitely appreciate everybody that does through our Patreon tips link and kind of following us on different platforms and sharing it out. So without further ado, let's dive into our first one. The Case Study of Vanitas Part 2, the show that Andrew keeps trying to get Chris to watch. Have you even started it?
I started it like 3 seasons ago.
The first part.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then just never went back to it.
Never went back.
And that's what I mean. Like, ever since then, Andrew's been trying to get Chris to watch it.
Technically, I did start it.
You did start it. Yes. Yes. But my attempts have failed, apparently. But yes. The Case Study Vanitas Part 2, or Vanitas no Carte Part 2. This one streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes. Studio is Bones. The source is a manga. The genres are historical, supernatural, vampire, fantasy, shonen. And this has a great team behind it. We have the director, Tomoyuki Itamura, who did the Monogatari series. Series composition by Hitomi Miyano, who did Snow White with Red Hair, Amanchu, Flying Witch, Noragami, Higehiro. The creator was Jun Mochizuki, who did Pandora Hearts. And the music was done by Yuki Kajiura, who, if you did not know, did all pretty much all the Type Moon stuff, all the Fate projects, because you could definitely hear that. But for those that are not aware of the series itself, part one essentially opens up with this idea that humans and mankind at some point were at war with each other, and at some point they kind of found some sort of peace and started, you know, living side by side. You have the vampires mostly living in sort of this alternate dimension Paris, where you have all the humans are pretty much in the regular Paris that we know it. And amidst this whole thing, you hear about the vampire of the Blue Moon, which essentially is this vampire that was kind of kicked out of the vampires and seen as, you know, evil because they were born under the Blue Moon, and they kind of cursed the vampires and said that they were going to create this book and use this book to manipulate their true name and curse them. Well, kind of opens up with us following this vampire named Noe, and Noe at some point comes across one of these curse bearers, one of these people that have had their true name corrupted, and they become, you know, pretty much unstoppable killing machines. And Vanitas shows up. This Vanitas, which is this vampire of the Blue Moon, or at least it's a human that has taken upon himself the name of Vanitas and now carries the book that this vampire once wielded that was cursing names. But it's weird that Vanitas is actually trying to help the vampires. He's trying to cure their cursed name and make them back to a regular vampire. Because normally, if you become a curse bearer, you're just kind of executed because they don't want vampires running around killing humans. It causes a little bit of a rift there. So nobody really trusts Vanitas that he's actually trying to help the vampires, but Noe and Vanitas kind of work together to find curse bearers, give them back their true name, and kind of cure them. So, and that's kind of was the gist of the first season. You started getting into the church. You started getting into the Chaucers, the Charlatans, which is like this group that's walking around and cursing names, and the history of Noe and his involvement with somebody close to him that became a curse bearer. And then getting into the second season, they quickly go to another area where they claim there's a beast that has showed up again. This beast of, like, these tales of this beast that showed up in this one area and massacred a lot of people. Well, apparently it showed up again. Vanitas believes it's a curse bearer, and so they're going to go there to try to see what it is and if they can help it. And this kind of turns into this whole big old thing about this vampire named Chloe. Her connections with different people, including Jean. And then eventually it goes into another story at the later part of this part two, which gets more into Vanitas and his past and his involvement with basically how he got to where he is now. We kind of got hints of Vanitas's history with his involvement with Moreau, the scientist that, you know, kind of did experiments on him, and Vanitas's connection with the actual Vanitas and all that kind of stuff, or what it seems like the actual Vanitas. So that's kind of the gist of part two. That's a lot to go through. This show has a lot of stuff to go through, and that's not even scratching the surface. And I think that's what I really love about the series so much, is it's got two things really going well with it. And that's characters, which every character is really fascinating in this world. They all have very multiple facets to them. They all have their driving force, of course, and they're all kind of interweaved in some way that's really, really interesting, that I always want to kind of see where it progresses. It's always been a fascinating thing for me for the series. And then you have really great chemistry. Obviously, Noah and Vanitas see things differently. Noah is more of the type that wants to resolve issues peacefully, whereas Vanitas is more brash and wants to solve things the most convenient way possible. So, like, a good scenario in the first part was a situation where they're trying to get from one location to another. So Noah is like, well, let's talk to them, because obviously they're misunderstanding the situation. Or Vanitas is like, no, let's take one of them captive and use them as a hostage to get to the situation. It's the aspect of trusting people versus not trusting people. And Vanitas has a serious distrust of people because he's not been through very good situations with really any side of the coin. He's equally been treated poorly by everybody, whereas Noah equally has been treated nicely by everybody. So there's kind of a mismatch of the chemistry between the two of them. And that's always been kind of the driving force for the first part, where I feel the second part is more driven by just really great story. Like, I always joke about the fact that when we got through part one, it was a buildup. It was a buildup into something really interesting to get into the world itself. And that was the driving force for me. Whereas when it ended, I'm like, that's kind of a weird place to end it. And I figured out really quickly when part two started, it just takes off and it doesn't let up. So I'm like, I'm kind of happy they stopped it where they did, because part two is just, it doesn't let up. And from the very first episode of part two, I was like, holy crap, this show gets better and better and better. The characters introducing, the insights into the world itself, the world formula, the leadership, the politics, everything is so good. And I really feel like this writer just keeps getting better every single chapter they write. And it does have me super excited for kind of where it goes. And this is definitely one of those ones where I'm like, I think when this ends, I'm going to check out the manga. And then unfortunately, I found out I caught up to the manga. So it's going to be a while before we get anything new on this series, which is a huge bummer for me. But at the same time, I love it. And I definitely want the writer to take their time. It seems like they're like a monthly release mangaka, so it's probably going to take some time. We're talking probably years before we get another anime adaptation, but I love it. I really do enjoy this series. I've always kind of enjoyed the style of it. It's very, again, they're in Paris, so it's got a very style like that. I'm never really a fan of vampire stories, but I think the way that this takes the story and the storytelling of vampires is really interesting to me, because it's more political and more, I guess, about the mechanics of being a vampire, like the whole true name aspect, getting into how it can be manipulated and how that kind of conflict between humans and vampires, which is, again, supposed to be neutral, is kind of always on a thread. And it's not so much about just being a vampire and swooning females and drinking their blood and that kind of stuff. It's more about the world itself and how everything kind of affects each other. So I guess it's just because of it being such a different take on vampires is why I enjoy it so much. Because, like I said, typically it's like, yeah, okay, yeah, charming looking vampire guy taking women and them fighting against those bad, evil vampires. I guess it's because you kind of see that the vampires are equally as good and evil. Maybe that's why.
The name thing was easily the thing that had the biggest draw to me. That was the thing that easily had piqued my interest the most.
And I seem to remember something did that as well, or maybe it's just a different, maybe it was something else that used the idea of names.
I'm pretty sure that some,
maybe a demon story that was like that.
I think so. It was either that or the objects that gained spirit over time and the name got corrupted in that or something like that. I don't remember.
Sugumomo is a show. Sugumogami. Yes.
Something like that.
I think that was it. But no, I really do enjoy it. Also, the really great thing is the main character that they kind of focused on for quite a bit of this particular part was Chloe, and she was voiced by Rika Jimia, so I was super happy about that. And I was super happy to find out that Chloe's story was really good. And I loved how it was tied in with Jean, which Jean has always kind of been my favorite character of the series. And then we got a backstory of Jean, including a scene with her with long hair, which was super gorgeous. Got some more into Domi. Domi has always kind of been like my second to Jean. Always loved her kind of chemistry with Noah, even though it's kind of a relationship built on tragedy. So they both equally have like this experience they had together, which was tragic. So they kind of form bonds through that. So you always kind of wondered if it was one of those aspects where I kind of wondered if the writer wanted to do something with this or if they were just pointing it out as just a reason for them to be together. And that's why I say when I feel like the writer's a good writer, when you get to that point where it acknowledges it, like it says, yes, I see it too. I meant this and here's what I'm going to do with it. And you go, holy crap. Like, I love Domi so much more. She did some crazy stuff at the later part of the second part. That's the stuff that I really eat up, is seeing how interweaved all the characters are and that everything is for a reason. And I think this writer is really good at that kind of stuff. I know that a lot of people's criticisms with the Case Study Vanitas was really probably in the first season. They just didn't feel like it was doing enough, especially early on. And I agree with that. I kind of felt, like I said, I was kind of more driven early on with the first part because of the chemistry between Noe and Vanitas. I felt like that goofy duo that was put together that obviously shouldn't be together. But what kind of grabbed me was getting into the vampire side of things, getting the Ruth Finn, the politics again from the vampire's perspective, how Vanitas was kind of throwing a wrench into what they had established. And then, like I said, getting into the second part where it seems like it takes a side trip going into this whole thing with Chloe and this beast that they've kind of rediscovered. I thought that it was going to get away from that. But then suddenly out of nowhere, all of these factions get involved. And again, all these factions have their own side that they want. The church wants to get involved. The charlatans are involved. Again, you have Noah and Vanitas, which is almost like a neutral party. And then you have the vampires getting involved. Everything kind of comes together really well. So, yeah, I can't express enough how much I love this series. It was definitely up there for me as one of my favorite shows of this current season. And it was one of my favorite shows of last year. So, and it's an unfortunate thing because it's got high ratings. Like, this show, if you look at certain sites, has really high ratings. I just don't think enough people talk about it. That's the weird thing. It's like, when I was watching this show on a weekly basis, it's like, yes, Dress Up Darling, everybody's talking about the episode and going, oh my gosh, you just wore this outfit. It's really great. And then you would see something like Akebi, which is, I'm happy we actually got conversation around that. Everybody talking about how wholesome it is and they're enjoying it. And you talk about Attack on Titan, obviously, Demon Slayer when it was on. This one is like crickets. It's like, it sucks because I want somebody to talk to about this show because like this happened. And it just like, holy crap, this happened. It was every episode had something happening in it that I was like, holy crap, this show is so good. And I cannot wait for the next episode. So definitely one of my biggest surprise hits amongst everything else for the last 2 years. So yeah, unfortunately, like I said, though, it's going to be a while before we see anything new for it. So that's the big unfortunate part of anything. That's probably the only downer that I can see in this series. So we'll see. Hopefully more not too far away. But it might be one of those ones where I might, as it kind of slowly pieces out each month, I might check it out. But it's going to be hard to... I have a huge problem with keeping up on show or mangas that are actually being released as it goes along. It's kind of difficult to remember to... Oh, yeah, then another one came out. But yeah, the Case Study of Vanitas or Vanitas no Cut Part 2. Definitely a high recommendation for me. Let's move on. How I Realized Hero Rebuilt the Kingdom Part 2 or Genjutsu Suji Yusha no Okoku Saikinki. Sorry. Trying to remember. Basically, this guy gets summoned to another world. This other world is sort of, you know, medieval times fantasy. And he's brought there because essentially as a way of paying the debts of the One Kingdom. So essentially this One Kingdom can use all their power to kind of summon somebody. And yeah, you would think that he's being summoned to save that particular kingdom. But no, that kingdom is basically going to use him as a bargaining chip to pay off their debts to another kingdom, which all these kingdoms are essentially currently facing an issue with this invasion of the Demon Lord's army. But he basically says, you know, instead of selling me off, why don't I help you with your debt issues, which they agree to. And so he kind of works to essentially try to pull this kingdom out of their debt issues and eventually gets handed the crown, much to the issue of most every other kind of leadership roles within this kingdom. But essentially follows him as he figures out ways of helping the kingdom and restore it in some way. Over time with the first part, they essentially get into the aspect of like all these different equal powers within the kingdom itself, which is really cool. You have this kind of system built that kind of prevents the king from being basically tyrant, in that you have basically a lot of your army and navy are kind of, you know, subsection to different groups within the kingdom itself. And they kind of get into that whole aspect and kind of an inner struggle within the kingdom itself. And yeah. And then it obviously catches the attention of the other kingdoms, which I think they kind of ended the last part with. So any updates on the synopsis before you get into it with part two?
Part two,
I dropped it pretty much.
Part two kind of goes a little bit more in depth into the three factions, and eventually a set of questions is answered that I think was very, very crucial, but it waits until the very, almost the last episode before it finally answers those questions.
Did it answer it in a way that cliffhangs it, or is it answer it in a way of, okay, now you have your answer, so you're good now?
No, it answers it in such a way that you're going, oh, that makes sense. And I think that those three questions, it's three questions. Those who watched the entire show will know what three questions I'm talking about. They're questions that you kind of go, you think about at some point, but you don't really dwell on it too much because the story is of such that it's constantly throwing stuff at you. And this is one of the biggest things that I'm of really of two minds of this story. I may dig into it a little bit more with Genius Prince. The thing about this story, there's so much really, really cool ideas in this world. You're constantly, Kazuya is constantly coming up with these really, really cool ideas. He discovers things that are really cool. At some point, in the second season, he finds something similar to uranium, and he realizes that he can bank on that and he can make a lot of money. It's not uranium, it's something similar. But the thing is you're constantly seeing these really cool ideas, but the writer doesn't seem to ever bring those to fruition. You don't see a payoff for it. You just say, wow, that's a cool idea. He acknowledges it. This is a really cool idea. This can help us do something good. But you never really see the finalizing of that. This paid off because of this.
I've seen that with the first part. So it kind of seemed that it's a common thing with the second part. Of course, when I was doing the first part, the thing that went in the back of my head that was there was like, well, it's probably because they didn't want to ruin the pacing, and maybe it's in the light novels. Maybe they just removed it for the adaptation. But that was definitely an issue that I kind of seen with the first part, is he would address issues, but you would never kind of see it. Like, for a good example, with the first part, they had this whole issue with this kind of overgrowing of the forest where the elves were. And he kind of acknowledged the idea that he kind of wishes that he had a system in play that would help them in bad situations. And never talk about it again.
Yeah. And that continues on. Even me and Andrew's, you know, joking back and forth, bickering about Poncho. I think Poncho was a brilliant idea. The problem is that you never really see a fruition of that. He basically created an idol industry. Never really see that's something that's brought up here and there, but it's never Poncho's brought up here and there. But when it comes down to it, there's no fruition to it. It doesn't say, yeah, this is what happened because of it. It's kind of like a I have a cookie here, but you can't finish the cookie. And that's one of the things that I got frustrated with going through the entire story is I do love the characters. I love a lot of the things that this show brings out, But like I said, I never get a satisfaction for any of those things. It's just we're just supposed to believe that all those things that he brought up is building to this great kingdom that he's making. But I don't have to necessarily see any of those things, and that it is kind of frustrating. So like I said, I'm of two minds. I love the characters, I love the story, I love the ideas, but at the same time, I kind of want some kind of a satisfaction for all those things that I'm getting out of it.
Again, that was I think Poncho was a good example of that, when the idea that when, and it was probably my first experience with that concept of. Again, it could be the writer, it just could be the way they're adapting it. That one way or another, I'm not saying one way or another, is that the first example of that was the whole call to the greatest of the greatest. It was like, oh, this is going to be really cool, this idea of, I've been a set guide in this world, obviously this place has issues, let me bring together the best of the best to fix the situation. And it, again, like I said, it was like a letdown to the idea of, so that's all you got? Like, you're talking about how your crops are messed up, but yet you didn't bring anybody in that's a farmer. You didn't bring anybody in that was an actual chef. It was a struggle because it was basically sidestepping. Yeah, maybe trying to subvert my expectations. I was expecting this and it did something else because the writer's like, yeah, you're going to expect that, so I'm going to do this instead, which is fine. But at the same end, it's like, you needed the call again, obviously, because something didn't go right here. You didn't get what you needed, obviously, according to everything you've built up to this certain point. And again, playing off that whole idea of not really following through with certain aspects. And that was my whole issue with Kazuya in the first season, was like, he would address things like, there should have been better people, it should have been some sort of a rescue plan in place for the elves. I knew this was an issue. I told them how they could fix it, but they didn't listen to me. I could have still done something to prevent disaster. And he was down on himself. I like that. I was like, holy crap, he's acknowledging his faults. They didn't do anything with it. It's like, you acknowledge your faults, but then you didn't follow up with it. And again, it was that kind of thing where I was struggling with Kazuya as a character, which is great. It's fine to struggle with a character's mindset if it doesn't feel like it's just bad writing. I didn't feel like it was bad writing. My whole thing was like, okay, Kazuya needs to acknowledge that he's only one person. Yes, he has a spell that can allow him to manipulate pens so that he can write multiple documents and do different things with it, but he could have delegated. He doesn't delegate. I don't know if that changes in the second part, but that was my frustration with him as a person, was that he couldn't delegate. And again, I don't know if that's a writing issue or if it's an aspect of maybe the writer just doesn't feel like that's important enough. Let's move on to funner things.
I can acknowledge that those kinds of things are, to a degree, dealt with in the second season. For a example, one of the biggest things that happened in the second season was, like I said, I mentioned the three dukedoms, and the
that aspect was really cool with the first season.
That came together. That came together fantastically in the second season, and I don't want to spoil anything because one of the biggest characters that you probably will think about had a massive thing that he had to deal with in the second season. And I really was impressed by what they did with that. And they didn't even do it in a cheap and easy way. He got pretty much put between a rock and a hard place. He had no choice as to what he was dealing with in that situation. And like I said before, there was three questions during the entire course of the show that you don't really think about that are actually acknowledged. And one of those questions involved that particular character. And it was done really well. But that would be overplaying the story as a whole. That was one of those things that I don't know if you remember, I was kind of hinting that maybe you should probably poke in. That was because of that particular storyline. As it was coming together, I was really excited about what was happening during that time frame, because of what they were doing there. So yeah, it's one of those frustrating. I'll probably at some point just tell you what happened, because it was really well done, and it didn't feel cheap what they were doing, and even the after effects of that particular situation ended up resolving. And that goes into what you were, the other thing that you were talking about of why didn't he delegate? Well, they actually kind of talk about that at a point because of basically corruption. So yeah, all of that is kind of handled. It's one of those funny things is the writer has a maturity about the way he's writing. So it feels like he's a good writer. He just doesn't have a knack for seeing things through. He's just good at catching ideas and saying, how can I incorporate that into this world? But to foresee where those ideas are going to go, it doesn't seem like he has a knack for that per se.
Yeah, I think the other thing that kind of frustrated me with the first part and why I pretty much decided that I wasn't going to get into the second part was, yes, the not following through, but it was also, it reminded me when you said this writer has a maturity about his writing. I'm like, I know what you're saying there, but my mind immediately goes to this idea of, yeah, sure, this idea of essentially trying to otaku inject into this world. It's kind of like, it reminds me of like taking the concepts of Outbreak Company and trying to make it serious. Like Outbreak Company was totally, essentially in your face about how goofy this idea was. They found a portal to another world, and essentially the government's trying to essentially corrupt that world and make them weak by introducing the otaku culture to make them essentially dumb and weak. And it played off that, and it did it in a comedic way while telling some really cool kind of serious sides to it. Whereas this one I feel is like, okay, how can Kazuya basically utilize otaku geekdom, which our readers are going to be into, to improve this world? Oh, let's make a cooking channel and introduce idols into the world, and that'll fix everything. And it does that. It does that whole thing of like, oh, yeah, that fixes everything. And it's like, sure, I guess. It doesn't really feel serious to me, but at the same time, sure. But I was going to ask you, the biggest question, obviously, anybody that watched the first part and didn't watch the second part is going to be questioning, did the animation improve?
Because nope.
My gosh, it fell apart later in the part one. Like,
well,
super bad.
It was pretty much standard. I don't think that it was.
Did it have more wars? You don't have to
outside
say what was the war was
outside of the,
because I think that's where it fell apart.
Outside of the dukedoms, yes and no.
And
there is one other thing that they deal with, but no, it did. It didn't really.
Did they finally utilize Tomoe?
Tomoe.
You don't know who Tomoe
yes,
is? She was the beast girl.
The lolly beast girl, I know. Yes and no.
She was the only, well, besides the smart guy, obviously I understand the idea of having somebody at your side that is very book smart and has the knowledge of the history. Tomoe was like the only other one that I was like, oh, that's a good choice. I understand why he chose her. She actually has a unique and special ability, so. And then she just disappears. They dressed her up one episode and that was it. And they were talking about adopting her and there was a struggle there, but it's like, okay, yeah, sure. Then she got thrown in the back burner. Hopefully eventually they'll utilize her.
That's the thing. It goes back to my original frustration of, like I said, they have a lot of cool ideas, never really follow through. It took me almost until the last five episodes before I finally got to Rurora. And I love her. I absolutely loved the concept of this kind of a character who's in the backgrounds. Kind of, she's a merchant, so she's doing things to make lots of money, and she's kind of in the backgrounds, just moving pieces around to ultimately make a lot of money. And finally, five episodes before the end of the show, they finally get her to where she's meeting Kazuya, and then they can
force their kind of destroy allies. Her country, though. Come on.
I don't want to dig into that, so.
Yeah, that's How a Realist Hero Rebuilt the Kingdom Part 2. Not Season 2. Don't get angry because Chris said Season 2. It's okay. You don't have to. Come on, we've just gotten announced Attack on Titan, the final season, part 3. Come on, it's all stupid at this point. I'm just tired of it.
I see somebody pointing that out. I was like, oh my gosh, seriously, they're dragging that out that long? Oh, wow.
Just keep doing the seasons. I don't know. Anyways, well, I mean, that's like Vanitas. Why do we have to do part 2? Just call it Season 2. Who cares? Make it simple. Make every single, like, even if it's going from, like, winter into spring, still call it season 1 and season 2, just to make it simple. just to call everything.
So that people
everything
don't bicker
seasons.
About whether or not we call them seasons or just, wars.
Just to make our life easier. Entire anime industry changed to make our life easier. Anyways, The Genius Prince's Guide to Raising a Nation Out of Debt. I did not plan that being right after it because they have a similar thing. Not completely similar, but it's got a similar feel to it. Tensai Oji no Akaji Koka Saisei Jutsu. This one's streamed on Funimation, ran for 12. It says, studio is Yokohama Animation Lab. This source is a light novel. The genres are comedy, fantasy. Series composition by Hitomi Mieno, who's done a crap ton of titles. Very good series composition writer. But yeah, this one opens up following... It's not an isekai, by the way. Let's start that off. I kind of probably cause an issue there by, you know, making a similarity between this one and the previous one. This isn't an isekai. This is just about a prince named Wayne. And the Prince Wayne's father, of course, is having issues. So he's kind of the next in line. And he's going to be inheriting this nation that is extremely in debt. It's not doing well. It's like way up in the north end of this entire continent. It's got, you know, it's in the snowy area. It doesn't really have much going for it. And like I said, it's extremely in debt. But he's having to carry it. But the whole joke early on is this idea of he just wants to figure out, you know, get it good enough so that he can sell the kingdom out and just, you know, ditch it. He doesn't want to have anything to do with his kingdom. He just wants to get what he can get out of it and get out of the whole situation, sell off the kingdom itself, which is kind of the starting joke. It really doesn't play off it again until like the very end. But yeah, it just kind of follows him as he deals with different relations with different countries. You have kind of basically what I've gotten out most of it is like mostly in the West, you have a lot of kingdoms over there. They're more kind of faith focused nations. They have a huge hatred for this certain race of people, which is of one of his right hand woman, which is Ninim. She's one of this particular race. I forget what the name of them was. Flam.
Anya. Okay.
Flam. I wrote down Flam, I guess. Flamu. But they hate that race. They kind of see them as subhuman. And then you have more on the east side. You have like the Empire, like this big, great nation, all the kind of stuff that deals with that as well. So you kind of find out over time that Wayne is a very smart guy. When he was in an academy, secretly, apparently, he was part of this one academy. He had insanely high grades. He was very skilled and all this kind of stuff, which most of that stuff kind of got kind of brushed under the rug and hidden away so that nobody knew about it. But essentially, like I said, his relations with those two sides, essentially keeping peace while at the same time trying to figure out some way of raising some sort of revenue and money for his particular kingdom. So again, he can, as he said at the beginning, sell it off and ditch. But yeah, over time, you get to meet different people like Loa, who is a part of the Empire, and her dealings with this whole fight over the crown of the Empire itself. Again, you get more into the Western side of things where you have the more... Again, more brutal inside of things. Again, more religious-based stuff that they get into with that. Falling out of different kingdoms and rebellions and all that kind of stuff that gets involved. All the while, again, Wayne's trying to both keep peace, gain allies, and not let his kingdom get destroyed. So, your thoughts?
This one, I actually, at the start of this season, the subject of this show kind of came up. And me and a couple of other... people that were on the Discord, we were discussing the idea of this one versus Realist Hero. And this is the funny thing about this story, that I tried really hard to stay kind of neutral on whether or not I would like this one, because the first episode or two, I will flat out tell you, I did not like this show. I liked Ninim. I liked a couple of the other characters that were introduced, but I did not like Wayne in the slightest. And to top it off, if those of you who listened to the first impressions, I absolutely hated the way they dealt with the war, with the kind of chess pieces and this is what we're doing and this is the strategy. It was all to set up Wayne as this hidden genius, and I get that. But if I had taken it at first stance, when I had gotten into discussing this with the one of the other people in Discord, if I had taken it at first glance, I would have flat out said I loved Realist way more than I liked Genius Prince. if I had judged it based on those first couple of episodes. Now, to be honest, I'm trying to set this up for an understanding. I think Realist and Genius Prince are doing very, very different things. Realist does some really interesting things.
I think the only similarity is that both of them are just trying to build up a nation.
Exactly. That's the only real commonality between the two.
And lots of waifus.
Genius Prince does this kind of thing. I hate to, because I've said this a few times with a couple of shows, but this one in particular is kind of more kind of Game of Thrones-ish in the way of it's kind of undercutting people who are coming against you, and there's these bringing together these allies and setting up the pieces. It's very surface level, but at least that's kind of the best way for me to explain it. It's this kind of playing behind the scenes to get the ultimate goal of whatever you want to bring out. Usually, in like Andrew said, it's always usually Wayne trying to bring this bring his nation up a little bit higher. And I like that about this story, and I love these characters. The characters in this one are hands down, I love them all around.
The female characters.
Yeah, well, even the guy, I actually got kind of a...
Which guy? Wayne?
I don't know about Wayne.
I'm just interjecting here because I feel like anybody that's not a female character in this show is a cackling bad guy cackling syndrome. Like, every male character in this show is a cackling bad guy. And
okay, I guess you're right. I'm sorry,
Nanaki, which I'm assuming is a boy. There's no telling. It could be a girl.
I did kind of like Groot. I thought he was kind of funny.
Did you catch his voice, by the way?
Mm-mm.
And you've seen him riding around in a chariot.
Right.
Rider from Fate Zero.
Was it? I thought I recognized his voice, but I wasn't sure.
That had to have been intentional. That had to have been intentional.
I got a kick out of him. Out of all the characters, for whatever reason, he was just this... And I loved
I just care about fighting.
I just care. Again, exactly.
Like, okay.
Well, I think he was more a be true to yourself, because that was the whole thing with the food thing as well. I liked that about his character.
Okay, he has one redeeming aspect of all the male characters besides Wayne.
Now, Caldamelia? I did not like Caldamelia. I love the concept of Caldamelia, but I did not like her. She's totally
the cackling.
She was kind of that.
There was one female that was the cackling bad guy.
I just want to see everything burn. But yeah, in general, I love the concept of this story. The idea of, like I said, this kind of surface level Game of Thrones-ish. I like the characters. But the problem is there's such a natural inclination to put this next to Realist and say, these two, compare them, which one did better? Well, yes, technically, I think Genius Prince did a lot better. It has some very solid writing, and it really does kind of ramp up towards the end of this show, and you can see that there is some real thought put into everything that's going on. But to base it off of two episodes and then put Realist Hero, which was, 14 episodes, which had already established itself, it wouldn't be fair of me to go, well, Realist Hero is naturally the winner, because I don't like the whole chessboard thing that they're trying to do in those first two episodes. It's not a fair comparison at all. And so that's why I was kind of leaning towards, let me get at least the first season or a few more episodes of Genius Prince before I make a decision on it. And this is where I'm at. I really, really like Genius Prince over Realist, but I don't think they're doing the same thing at all. And Realist Hero, I really love as well. So take that for what it is.
That was a long explanation to say that what you thought about it in the first two episodes. So I did go back to watch the show because Chris was saying there was some good things in here to check out. And I will say that I enjoyed it in the end, because I think The one thing that I can give this show is that it's very different. You're not going to really find anything like The Genius Prince's Guide to Raising a Nation Out of Debt. That's a really long title. The Genius Prince. You're not going to really find anything like Genius Prince anywhere else. It is literally doing something very different, and I do like it for that. And I do like the cast. I like the female characters in the show. Because I think, again, but I think that's a syndrome of the writer. The writer gets way too caught up in really a formula. And this is my issue that I really had with the series overall, is I feel like this writer has a formula with every encounter that Wayne has. He basically has an issue arise. Either somebody's invading somebody, or there's somebody invading him, or somebody's trying to get him pulled into a dispute. And then he gets involved. And then he will essentially, you'll find out that there's a female involved. They're a princess, or they may be a princess, whatever. There's a princess involved. And that's the only good person in the mix. All the guys are cackling evil guys. Again, except for Caldamilia. She's a cackling female character. She's the only cackling female character. They're always a cackling male characters. They all wanted either to be discriminatory against the Flom, or they just want to kill everybody. And then Wayne has to essentially teleport behind a door when somebody's talking about this crucial moment. He will then appear through the door and say, I've been listening the whole time. I had everything according to Kakaku. I win. And they just accept what he says, and that they can't overcome his genius. And then he wins, or he just stabs everybody to death and then somehow gets away with it. That's my issue with this writer. They're very formulaic in conflict, cackling bad guy, cute princess that he needs saving. Wayne appears behind the door, opens the door, says according to Keikaku, and all according to plan. For those that don't know the joke about Keikaku, all according to plan, you can't dispute it. They go, wah, I can't dispute it. He either stabs them and kills them, or they accept that and they move on. That's my problem with this writer. Again, I think it's unique in that it's a very different take on storytelling that you don't really see in anime, and I did enjoy it for that. And again, I do enjoy the female characters. Loa was great. I loved her very kind of trying to pull Wayne into situations, which is always fantastic. It got old after a while, but it was still good. Fallen, the sister, I felt like she was a little bit too easy. Like, I assumed that was going to be the case. Like, she's going to suddenly stand before everybody and change everybody's hearts, and they all follow her. But it was still cute in the end, and I did enjoy that aspect. Wayne, I agree with you. I didn't like Wayne at all at first. I kind of still don't like him in the end, because he just, and this is me overthinking it. And I did this one in the first impressions. I overthink it, and that's just how I am. I feel like he's the biggest heartless bastard ever, because he puts people's lives in danger all for benefit. Like, it literally never addresses the idea that he doesn't like the idea of war, that he doesn't like the idea of his people dying, because he's willing to put them out there over really stupid things. And that was kind of what they did with the first arc, and it never really addresses that later on. So I kind of just feel like he's just a heartless bastard in the end. But
Fanya is.
I figured Fallon, and it was the reason why Chris was like, you gotta watch this, because she did something cool. And the moment it comes up, I'm like, oh yeah, this is why Chris liked the show, because cute lolly girl swoons all the hearts. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. It was
no, I liked Ninyam. I liked Loa, and I liked Ninyam her.
Surprisingly, Ninyam was so underused.
Yeah,
I was super surprised. Like, the very beginning arc was like, it was all about her showing up and just destroying everybody, and was like, okay, so why does everybody not like these people? Because they seem like they're super, like super combat geniuses or whatever. But I guess it didn't really imply that. But yeah, in the end, it was like all she does is just show up every now and then and talk to Wayne. This doesn't, like, every battle after that, she's never there. It's like, why isn't Ninyam involved?
Anyway, Fanya, the one of the cool things about Fanya that I really did like is they used
her. Is it Fanya or Falana?
Falana, whatever.
I'm just wondering if I put it wrong.
I think that's the reason why I called Flom wrong, because I was getting her name stuck in my head.
Japanese pronunciations, yeah, are right. Not Japanese names.
The cool thing about her that I really did like is they used her for almost an basically walls of text. they were using
exposition.
That's the word. Yeah, damn it.
What are you talking?
They were using her as almost a way to let the reader understand what's going on.
Oh yeah, every time there was something big happening, it's cut to her being taught by a mentor,
and I kind of just passed her off as this kind of way for exposition to happen. And so when they actually used her in that whole arc where they brought her into this other kingdom and then they started...
She's nodding at her and she's like, oh, obviously he wants me to do it.
Yeah, right?
That was cute.
It was kind of one of those... That's kind of cool that they kind of brought her into the story more into the mainstream or more into the spotlight using that. So I did really like that they did that with her. I understand that what Andrew's saying is it was convenient that because she's cute, she wins over the hearts of all the people. But
it's like chaos happening, and she steps in this audience room and says, and I thought she was going to say something like really profound, like she was going to talk about like something significant. But it's literally her saying, everything's going to crap. We should come together. And they're all like, she's right. Suddenly, all of our disputing is done. Cute girl. And I'm probably going to be the one that would say that. She's adorable, so why not, guys? Let's try.
It comes down to that I do think that was one of the things that I do kind of like about this writer is he doesn't leave characters off to the side. Outside of
Nanaki.
Who?
Nanaki. the other Flom.
he's helping. He's protecting her from the shadows.
He's like, Nineveh's like,
or Rhea Kajimia. They just threw her. They had her up there for one screen. I'm like, oh, Andrew, Rhea Kajimia's in here. And they never used her again. I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
She was great. She's just like, let's talk about food. I'm like, all right, Rhea Kajimia, let's talk about food. I don't want to talk about anything else because they're just cackling bad guys. Sure enough, when she goes over, when the sister goes over there, suddenly out of nowhere, door opens. I'm like, what? Do you guys just let this guy walk around everywhere? Like, how did he get there? Who let him there? It's just funny. It's funny. I will say, I was very impressed. We had one of those situations in the show, and I'm not going to really expand on exactly who it is, because who cares? Spoiler, obviously, but... They had one character who had like this identity, a secret identity. And I'm like, shoot, I'd be fooled by that secret identity because where the hell did they hide those two things? It's like, all right, we're going to go out in the town. And I'm like, okay, I'm pretty damn sure this is the girl earlier and her secret identity, but I'm not sure. She is saying that she's actually like, what do they call them? Like those mediators or whatever. She was saying that she was like some sort of mediator, but I'm like, okay, is she joking or is it really her? Because where did those two things go? Like, where is she hiding those?
It's like one of those, like, they brought that up on the Discord.
Focus.
They brought that up on the Discord and I'm like, bandage.
They're like, that can't
happen. That's not physical. It doesn't matter. It's anime. Anime does that all the time. Why is this surprise? They did it in
I was half tempted to post a Twitter post saying, by the way, this is the same person. Because it's like, it's bad because it's such a focus for Wayne. Because obviously when Wayne sees it, he's like, whoa. It's that whole aspect of like, he just locks on to those things. And obviously, just to make Ninim mad, because Ninim thinks that she's small chested. I really didn't get that, but she really does feel like she's flat justice. But yeah, I guess just to play that.
Ninim is awesome. I love Ninim.
But yeah, like I said, besides like Wayne's insane amount of plot armor, he has like godlike plot armor, which blows me away. Like how he didn't get killed so many times. Basically confronting people that want him dead and still somehow not get killed instantaneously blows my mind. Again, besides the cackling bad guy characters, which I honestly didn't find any of the quote unquote bad guy characters at all interesting. Like I said, yeah, I can see Chris's point with Greer. But again, it's just replace the cackling bad guy with the I want to be true to yourself, fight war because I love war. Besides that aspect, I did enjoy the characters and kind of, again, the more unique take on building a nation, the more unique storytelling that you don't typically see in anime, which I do give it that a lot of credit, but yeah, it was just a frustrating show to watch. It's like a mix between being frustrated and just kind of going with it at times. So
it's one of those things. Like I said, the whole comparing the two, I like,
you're stuck on that. Just,
yes,
you
have, I
just
am.
Stop talking about it.
It's important.
Nobody cares.
I do hope that this one, and I do at least feel like the writer is good. But putting the two next to each other, at least one, I'm getting constantly new ideas. This one, I'm getting kind of a good solid through of just weaving stories. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, I'm not as anticipating the ending on this one as I am on the other one.
You know what frustrates me most about you keep going back to that? The reason why it makes me laugh is because here recently somebody came to us and was talking about, hey, I was thinking about taking, I really liked Asterisk War. But what I kept finding whenever I looked into things about Asterisk War was people talking about the Chivalry of Fell Knight. And I'm like, well, the story behind that is because they were the same season and everybody was comparing the two. Because literally the first episode for both the shows was like almost spitting image, like mm-hmm. scene for scene was like spitting image of each other. It became a joke. And then everybody after that kept making comparisons through the entire season because it was good YouTube content, apparently. And yeah, technically they had a lot of fun bashing the hell out of Asterisk War, which I don't think necessarily deserved it. But yeah, that's going to be the case with this. Like suddenly somebody's going to look back at Genius Prince and go, what's this other show? Realist Hero? What? Or the opposite effect for the other one. But anyways, it's funny. But yeah, Rikijima did not get enough attention. That made me mad. I did end up seeing her when I was looking up Rikijima here recently because I was like, okay, is she? Did I miss something this season that she did? And yeah, sure enough, bunch of side characters that had like two lines. Fantasy Bestojo, which we'll talk about here in a minute. Actually, the next show that we're talking about had the same issue. There's Rikijima. She has two lines and then you never see her again. It's like, I swear, I think Rikijima is retiring, or maybe she just asked for too much. I don't know. It could be. But yeah. Genius Prince's Guide to Raise a Nation Out of Debt. I suggested if, again, you're looking for the aspect of a different storytelling and you're okay with the cackling bad guys and you want just a different take on storytelling and anime in general and the idea of, you know, again, raising your nation, fighting against different nations with their own ideals. Because, I mean, it does make sense. It does make sense that Wayne's constantly thrown in those situations because nations want power and they all want to fight over power. And that's what you're kind of going to run into. So I just wish the bad guys were more well written, honestly.
But if you like nation building, this, to me, I love it. That's I love this one, so.
Do you think nation building? Because I think besides the whole aspect of him trying to get gold, it wasn't really like,
I think that
nation building like I'm thinking, like where they're, okay, well, we need to do this in order to build up this side of the nation, or we're low on this supply, so we need to do this. I felt besides the gold thing and the trade between the Empire and the West Front, specifically like different groups, but
I see your point, but when it comes down to it, it's going to be thrown into that category for whatever reason.
Yeah. There you go. Life of an Ordinary Guy Who's Reincarnated into a Total Fantasy Knockout, which I don't know how the hell they got that title. I think it was just what they used for maybe the manga translation or something. But the Japanese title is Fantasy Bishoujo Juniku Ojisan To, which I think is like just basically fantasy girl reincarnated
girl.
Old man. Yeah, it's like old man is reincarnated as a fantasy girl. It's really what the title is. But anyways, it's streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by OLM Team Yoshioka. The source, again, is a manga. The genres are adventure, comedy, and fantasy. And this one opens up following two characters, and I absolutely hate one of their names, so keep that in mind. I'm probably going to butcher it a couple times throughout this. Tachibana and Jinjuji. And Tachibana and Jinjuji are basically childhood friends. At some point when they were in school, they met each other, and they've been pretty much inseparable since then. But obviously there's an issue, at least from our perspective of Tachibana's side, between the two of them, and the idea that Jinjuji is like a woman magnet, and Tachibana wants to find a girl, and they're in the working force, and yeah, they go out on dates and stuff like that, but all the women just flock to Jinjuji. So Tachibana's like goal is to find a girl for Jinjuji, so that he's taken, so that Tachibana can finally find a girl. But that's an issue because Jinjuji doesn't really find women attractive. He's kind of just doesn't trust them and all this kind of stuff. So he just never really attaches to any women. So at some point, while Tachibana is drowning himself in drinking because he's upset about this, he ends up falling down in the middle of nowhere. Jinjuji's there with him. And Jinjuji's like, you know, I just want to get you home. Tachibana's like, you know, I just should become the ideal girl. That way I don't have to worry about finding the ideal girl. Well, insert goddess from another world. She appears out of nowhere and says, is that guy dead? I need him dead so that I can reincarnate him into another world. Oh, well, I'll just blast you both with a huge magic arrow and kill you. That way you can reincarnate to my world. And so they get transported to this other world where this goddess basically says, I need you guys to find and defeat the demon lord. And oh, yeah, by the way, essentially she granted the wishes that they had, which turns out is Tachibana becoming the ideal girl. And you'll find out a little bit later, Jinjuji getting a unique skill to take Tachibana home, because that was his wish, was just to take Tachibana home. So he can actually create a door that will open up into Tachibana's home. So, yeah, so the two of them essentially have to go find and defeat the demon lord, which Tachibana wants to do really quickly because he doesn't want to be a female. But also there's an issue with a charming effect that kind of seems to be happening between the two of them, in that Tachibana is the ideal girl and Jinjuji finally is attracted to a girl and it happens to be him. So he's fighting over that, while Tachibana now kind of sees Jinjuji as being reliable and handsome because now he's this you know, cute girl. So yeah, shenanigans unfold as they travel around the world and deal with the fact that Tachibana is the ideal girl. So everybody's charmed by her or him. So that's an issue. So yeah, your thoughts on Total Fantasy Knockout.
On the easy side, I did like the show. It's generally fun, goofy. It doesn't do anything exceptionally crazy. My frustrated side is when I first watched this show and we did the first impression, I was absolutely emphatic about how funny the show was. And I literally, I remember specifically saying they're about to introduce Kirito, and I can't wait to see what they do with Kirito. And I'm saying Kirito, his name is Schwartz von Lichtenstein.
Yeah, don't call him by Schwartz or anything. It's Schwartz von Lichtenstein.
It's frustrating in the fact that I literally said that. And I was super excited about what they would do with this character, because they took the pretty much all the tropes in the first couple of episodes and they were toying with them and they were going nuts with them. And I couldn't wait to see what they were going to do with him, because it would be funny to see somebody actually just tear apart Kirito. That never really happened. They kind of played on the idea of him being an edgelord, doing a chunibyo with him, but it
played a little bit on the idea of his ability being like super powerful, but he's like, that's extremely reckless. You're destroying property, yeah. That kind of aspect, but that's not that much.
And this was the point in which I really felt like this, all the jokes kind of started getting kind of old, and it was really frustrating, because like I said, it is goofy and fun. The storyline towards the end, they kind of got into this kind of, they were toying with the idea of the relationship that was building between Tachibana and Jinguji, but it really never really got to fruition. But that makes sense, because you can't really put them together. It's got to be a will they, won't they all the way through. But yeah, it did really kind of feel like it fell off. It really about this time of Kirito for me. And that's just where it is. It just was a goofy, fun show pretty much all the way through.
Yeah, that was kind of the feeling that I had. Obviously, the big thing was going to be the staying power. I typically have this hesitation with shows that have the title is the joke that they introduced at the very beginning. Because it's always like that aspect of, okay, well, you titled the story or you titled the manga literally the punchline of the first volume or the first chapter. That kind of lets me to believe that you're trying to get a bunch of sales on the first chapters, and that way you can pull in people for buying multiple chapters. So there's always a fear whenever I see that. Whenever you see a title is literally the joke of the first chapter, there's a concern about staying power. And that's obviously the concern that we had when we were doing our first impressions. And I felt like for the at least the first three or four episodes, it had staying power. It had a great idea, had a great concept. Again, heavily playing on this this uncomfortableness that Tachibana has with Jinguji, and the idea that I see you attractive, I see you attractive. The charm effect, this idea of Tachibana doing something that he doesn't realize is really risque, and then Jinguji basically grabbing him and chucking him into a bandit camp because he doesn't want to get charmed. That stuff was hilarious. I loved it. But again, staying power. It didn't have it. It didn't feel like the writer had enough here. And it really does suck because you knew right off the bat that this writer was going for an isekai parody. Let's take all the tropes of isekais and just mess with them, but also additionally having the gender swap aspect, which sadly we haven't really had much in a long time. Now, granted, we had two in this season, which was shocking, but the idea of, like, back in the day when we watched shows, most every show in, like, early 2000s and 90s and stuff always had the gender swap episode where suddenly out of nowhere everybody just gets swapped genders and shenanigans happens. It was always great. It was a lot of fun, and it introduced, you know, question marks around characters. And this is literally doing a whole show on it or whole story on it. And again, not enough staying power for it. It was great early on, but yeah, I would probably say about the same time when the introduction of Schwarz von Lichtenstein, it went downhill. There was a couple jokes around him that were funny, but then following that, it just went downhill. And that was two story arcs after that. They had one story arc was this idea of them basically having a sacrifice of Tachibana for this god. And then the falling thing was the Jinguji and, well, it was technically the rebellion. This whole thing about this group of people, this kingdom and whatever, that's completely surrounding the goddess of beauty that brought them there, and how none of these people are. And then it went quickly into essentially establishing the bonds between Tachibana and Jinguji, which I did like. Like, it is one of those aspects of, like, for comedy, it started off really strong, but it just petered off. But I do feel like that later arc had a purpose, and that was really establishing the bonds between these two guys. They're cool. Like, these are bros above all bros. And I love that aspect. I love the idea of them fully acknowledging, yes, that Tachibana has always been jealous of Jinguji and how frustrating that makes him and how he wants Jinguji to acknowledge that. But then on the opposite end, realizing that it's an equal issue. That Jinguji has the same jealousies and frustrations about Tachibana. And you never really realize that until the very end when it finally acknowledges it. So I felt like there was a purpose to that later arc. So don't get me wrong. I just felt like it was an extremely weak arc outside of that. The whole rebellion and everything was just kind of like, shrug. It's not funny. It's not interesting. None of it. And that's where I think it falls apart. It's like, it's really good comedy starting off. It had a cool punchline at the very end regarding the characters themselves, not necessarily comedy, but everything else in between there is just shrug. And that was my frustration. And probably an equal frustration that Chris has as well, is it's not an aspect of wanting to hate on the show. It's just that it started so good. Like, you had it. Like, this writer had it. This was so good starting off. Watching this town being ransacked by bandits, and suddenly Tachibana just strolls in, and suddenly they're all killing each other and claiming they're going to be the one that marries Tachibana. It was great. Yeah. Again, watching Jinguji freak out because Tachibana did something that he didn't realize was very, very erotic, grabs Tachibana and chucks him into a bandit camp. It's great. Like, that stuff is hilarious. One-shotting a bear and then realizing it's some sort of sacred beast to the elves and somebody eating the meat. Was great. Like, those things were great. And then Schwarz von Lichtenstein shows up, and the writer just suddenly runs out of content, runs out of really any fun. And that's the frustrating thing. So, yeah. Either way, though, if that's interesting to you, I'd definitely suggest it. Some people might find some of the later, again, technically comedy subjective. Somebody could probably say that, no, the entire show had me laughing out loud, and that I totally welcome it. So
yeah, by all
so
means.
If the concept itself is interesting, you definitely check it out. You might find it a lot more funny. You know what the one thing was introduced that could possibly have answered why it kind of drifted off? The crown. It was about the same time that Tachibana got the crown, and that whole joke disappeared.
That's true.
Now, granted, the writer probably introduced that because they were like, you know, look, this is going to get old, so maybe it was a good thing, but I don't think yeah, you, I can see that getting old, and introducing the crown basically prevents that from getting old, and they can focus on a thing, but I just don't think they had that other thing to replace it, so. Yep. That's fun. Fun stuff. Life with an Ordinary Guy Who Gets Reincarnated into a Totally Fantasy Knockout. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Next one we have is, she professed herself pupil of the wise man, or Kinja no Deshi wo Nanoru Kinja. It's streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Acat. Sources, light novel, genres, art, adventure, fantasy. The director is Kaitaro Motonaga, who did Katanagatari, Dead Alive, Ray Earth, and more. And this one essentially, I don't know, I... essentially opens up talking about this this Ark Earth Online, which is this really fantastic MMO that has, like, it kind of goes out of its way to kind of point out this is like an MMO that's like a living, breathing, evolving world. Like, you can do anything in this world. There's no limits to what a person can do. You go in there, you can be a miner, you can be a crafter, you can be a warrior. And they kind of emphasize the idea that the world itself kind of breathes and builds. And so you have people playing the game. You have them essentially able to create towns, villages, nations, all this kind of stuff. And they build all this stuff. And they get into this whole idea of this one particular person named Dunboff, who is like this one of many of these nine wise men who are like extremely powerful players that are within this one kingdom of Arkite. And eventually... snap forward, suddenly out of nowhere, Dunboff has been, his character has been turned into a cute little girl, and he's returning back to this nation, and apparently a lot of time has passed. Apparently the other players are still in this world. Dunboff might be captured in this world, but Dunboff is now a cute girl, so they have to hide the identity that he, this big, crazy, powerful, wise man, warrior, old man, is now a cute girl, so they decide to essentially say that he's Mita, this Dunboff's pupil. So that's the punchline of the title itself. So I think beyond that point, I don't remember much. So if you can expand beyond that point, please do. I think they were talking about trying to find the rest of the nine wise men because the nation was no longer going to be at peace with other nations. They had like an agreement to be at peace, and that was going to go away. So they needed to regather the nine wise men. So apparently that went away after I stopped watching.
Yeah, no, gathering the nine wise men was pretty much the entire thing of this entire show. So I forgot that there was a peace thing that involved.
Yeah, Solomon was talking about the peace was going to go away, and he needed to kind of rebolster their standing by reintroducing the wise men because they all apparently disappeared. I don't know. Did they ever establish that they're all trapped in this world? But they've, is, because my thought process is that it was going to be similar to another show this season, which I won't say because it would technically spoil that one. In this idea that everybody gets isekai'd into this game world, but all at different dates. Like I think they were mentioned that Dunboff was like gone for like 30 years or something like that. It was weird.
I don't know. This is literally my, we make the joke.
Oh yeah. And pee fetishes. I forgot about that. That's an important thing to add to the synopsis of this show. It really likes watching Dunboff pee as a girl, cute girl.
I'm not going to argue that one at all. Every time there's always this one show that Andrew will get stuck on something and I'll say, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. Every time I want to say it's not that bad, he's doing it again. And it's so, like, I don't even care. Yes. This show is about pee fetishes.
It was funny because when I stopped watching it, I think it was like four episodes in, I joked about this with somebody. I'm like, this got a lot of it. And they were like, yeah, I don't think it happened that many times. I'm like, no, it happened that many times. I'm just not going to go back and recount it. But I think it was like three times. And then suddenly out of nowhere, they watched the next episode and they came back to me and said, they did it again. So they added another one to the count. And then they talked about, I guess apparently later on, there's literally like this tree that.
No, that was me that told you about the freaking
them
tree.
To be on the thing. I had like three people tell me about the tree.
Okay.
Because I joked about it in the first impression. So everybody has to let me know there's literally a quest. Essentially, or something to that effect, where they're trying to get him to pee on something. It's like, okay, this writer, it's confirmed at that point. Like,
I'm not even going to argue about the stupid pee fetish in this one.
They have Fricka, who's like obsessed with whatever juices he's throwing on this mirror. It's like, okay, wow, this writer is, it's not this bad. I mean, you do you, but. Sure.
This is we've made the joke about the The show that you never know what you feel about this. And this is one where I went into this show, I wanted to like it so freaking bad. And I remember in my first impressions going, I hate that I don't like this show. I don't like the writing. I don't like the storyline is kind of interesting, but I don't like it. I don't like the concept of it. I want this show to be much better than it is. And I'm so frustrated about this show. Even walking away, I'm getting annoyed at having to talk about this show. This is how much I love Mira. Let me explain this very clearly. I love Mira.
Whoa, is that dumb buff?
I want to like this show, and I can't. Everything about this irritates the crap out of me, and it's frustrating because I've talked about this snowball effect before. Why didn't you stop watching? Because I wanted to like it. I really, really, really wanted to like the show, and I got through this entire show.
We don't hate watch, by the way. I don't find fun in hate watching.
I don't so exactly.
If I really hate something, I'll stop watching. It's exactly. Like Sabu Kuibisco. I did not have high praise for Sabu Kuibisco, but I wanted it to be good. I wanted it so bad to be good.
Exactly, and that's this show for me. Is I wanted to like this show so bad that. While even when I finished it up the other day, I sat here and I went back and forth in my head about why did I continue watching this? Literally why? And all I can say is I really liked Dumbledore, Mira. I like her character artwork. I like I like some of the characters out around her. For all of my cheesy jokes about because I wanted to call him Nero, it's Solomon. He comes off as this Nero for whatever reason, and I kept wanting to call him Nero. A lot of the world building that they had in here is kind of cool. The problem is, it's like Andrew was asking, well, did they ever get into who it was? There other characters that were trapped in the MMO? I don't know. I really don't. Nero or Solomon.
They specify that Solomon and, at least from as far as I watched, they specify that Solomon and Luminaria were players. Just wasn't getting a clue on, are they trapped there?
That exactly.
Is Dunbolf trapped there? Because it basically just says Dunbolf said, I fell asleep in the character creator and it turned my character into a cute girl. But I'm like, but are you trapped there? You're talking about senses being better. Is it just that the game got an upgrade and you came back to play after a while of being away from it? It doesn't say if they're trapped or if they're, again, just not playing for a little bit and coming back. Did he sleep for 30 years? What exactly happened?
Yeah, that's the thing.
And then I have people sending me chats and comments saying, this is what's happening. I'm like, no, I don't want to read it. I want the show to tell me. Otherwise, I can't review it properly because obviously the show didn't tell me right.
Exactly.
I don't want to review it saying, this was confusing, but don't worry because you can just read the novel to find out the answer to it. So it's still a good show. No, that's not how reviewing an anime works.
Yeah. And that's the thing is there's... And then the freaking CG.
Gosh.
I hate the CG goblins.
I almost forgot to mention it, and you were the one to bring it up.
That's how bad it was. I hated the CG goblins. It's one of those things.
Gargoyles and everything. The knight was okay, but just, yeah, it looked all bad. Oh, yeah, the chicken. I forgot about the chicken.
Literally,
was it a rooster?
So, literally, I just want a show with Mira and everything else about this
Before I forget. So you're telling me that they did well with Dunbolf / Mira, because what I was gathering from the first three or four episodes is zero personality from Dunbolf. It mentioned this idea that he liked role-playing, and they were really into it when it was before he got changed into a girl and possibly Isekai'd. I don't know if he was Isekai'd. And then after that, it was really just, I need to go over here. I need to pee. I need to go over here. Let me think about these different players and what they were into, but I never got a personality from Mira. So
no, that's the entire show.
Just the reaction.
That's pretty much the entire show. He goes from place to place, and that was it.
What makes you like a character? That's I guess the question.
I don't know.
she's cute. Because she's cute. Just say that. I don't mind you saying
I did. I said she's cute. I like her artwork. I don't – outside of that, I don't like anything else. I watched this entire show for Mira, and I didn't get anything else.
It's okay, Chris. It's all right. You can
that's the truth. And that's why I'm so frustrated with the show. I wanted to like this show, and I couldn't. It's that frustrating. I hate it. I'm sorry, guys. I hate that I did this. I hate that I have to give this show a 0.5 out of – because Mira is cute.
Mira is cute out of 10. So, yeah, that's In Another World with my bladder. She professes herself people.
I just made that up. It's good. I like it. Somebody's going to bash me for liking the show only for her. I'm a horrible person.
I almost want to say what they're going to say, but that would just make them say that. Everybody makes fun of me because I like what's her face
giant
from
Girls. You like Giant Girls.
Obviously, I like Giant Girls because I like one character who was voiced by Rika Jima. And then suddenly out of nowhere, I like Giant Girls. So now they're going to say you just like pee fetishes. Yeah, she professor herself peaceable of the wise man or In Another World with my bladder. All right, moving on. We have Love of Kill or Kuroshin Ai. This one streamed on Crunchyroll and for 12 episodes, done by Studio Platinum Vision. Sources of manga, genres are action and romance. The director was Hideaki Oba, who's been around for a long time, mostly doing children's stuff, which is kind of weird, but good on him for branching out. But essentially opens up in Japan following a bounty hunter named Chateau. Well, I will claim I never seen that she was a bounty hunter, but everybody said that it says that she's a bounty hunter. So I'm gonna agree with everybody that she's a bounty hunter. And it kind of opens up with her on one job where she ends up running into an assassin named Rang Ha Song. And after they have a little tussle, they fight back and forth. Rang Ha Song essentially gets the upper hand, tackles her down, and starts asking questions about her, like her name and everything. And eventually says, you know, look, I'm asking these questions because I'm kind of interested in you. What kind of follows this is Chateau continuing to do her job, working at this location and going out and doing different jobs. And the entire time being pursued by this assassin, Rang Ha Song. Rang Ha Song is a very well-known assassin. He's killed a lot of people. He's got a bounty on him and everything. Even at some point, they even get a job at Chateau's place to hunt down Rang Ha Song. But the entire time, he's basically pursuing her, trying to be romantic with her. She keeps kind of brushing him off, like, you know, why are you so interested in me? Leave me alone kind of thing. But he kind of ends up doing things to help her with her jobs just because he's trying to get her interest, even taking hostages to force her to have to go on a date with him and everything. It's kind of the whole shit going on. Over time, you kind of have, and mostly at the after credits points of pretty much most of the early episodes, you kind of get a sense that the two of these are kind of connected in some way. The two of these, Chateau and Song, are connected in some way. And over time, Chateau kind of getting involved with groups of people that want Song dead, and basically her life being put in danger because of that. So, yeah, that's Love of Kill. And anyway, the blossoming romance between the two of them. Did you end up finishing this one?
Nope.
Big shock. Okay, so my mindset early on, easily with the PVs and everything, was I was kind of interested in this show because it was a dark romance. It was a very violent show. It doesn't really shy away from death and murder and all this kind of stuff. Obviously, Song being an assassin, he's surrounded by death all the time. And it had like this really weird, very dark take on romance and the idea that you would have these cases where Song is calling up Chateau to kind of check in on her, and he's literally standing in a pool of blood with a bunch of murdered bodies around him. It's, again, this is a really twisted, dark story about with a little bit of romance in it, or at least a pursuing of somebody by somebody else. You can debate on if it's romance or not, but essentially this assassin has an interest in Chateau. And at the same time, it doesn't seem like she really wants anything to do with him. She doesn't really seem like she has any sort of want in romance, nor does she see any sort of benefit to him whatsoever. He's a dangerous person. And I think the thing that kind of kept me going, despite the fact that most people I agree with, it felt very forced. It felt very overpowering. This guy is literally just forcing himself on Chateau. And it feels kind of wrong in that sense. But at the same time, It's reality. There's people like that. They will kind of push themselves on somebody when they have an interest, and you can debate if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I think the thing that kind of the thread that kept me going throughout the series was, again, the fact that it was supposedly a dark romance. But in the other sense, there was this thread, this thing that they were kind of slowly carried on a sticking me. They were giving me these breadcrumbs about a possible connection between the two of these characters that really did have me kind of pulling through a lot of that. Again, I understood frustration about this pairing. This pairing doesn't make sense. It's very forced. It's very overpowering. And again, what could be the writer's intent to really have this? This doesn't feel like a healthy relationship. This doesn't feel like something that you're, as a viewer, even supporting. What is the driving force here? What is so interesting? And I think over time it does answer that question. And I do think that question mark of why Song is interested in Chateau is answered. Now here's the frustration I have. It's one of those things where it answers why he's interested in Chateau. And why Chateau, in the end, could possibly be receptive to that. The frustration comes in the idea that it feels a little bit too convenient in a sense. It has an aspect to it where you're kind of like, yeah, I can see why he's interested in her, but at the same time, it's a stretch to say that he would go out of his way to really pursue her. But in the end, it does connect the two of them in a way that I can kind of feel there being an interesting dynamic here. Again, I fully acknowledge that this is not your typical romance. This is no way, shape, or form your typical romance. And I won't say that I think it's healthy. Like, it's a very unhealthy relationship that they're sort of trying to push here between the two of these characters. But at the same time, I like that in the element of being unique. It feels like two broken characters finding some sort of connection with each other. Because like I mentioned really early on, Song is a very nasty person. He feels like a very nasty person. He feels like a very dangerous person that has been through, that has basically seen death his entire life. And Chateau, you kind of immediately connect to as being, I don't want her involved in this. And your mind immediately goes to the element of, I don't want her involved with it. But she's technically involved with it. Like, she's already in it. She just doesn't realize it. And I think that, again, that element of making a connection between the two of them is different. Again, you can say it's unhealthy, and I won't disagree with you, but it was still interesting in the end. And that was really, again, the driving force that I had. Now, getting into my problems with the show. And on one hand, again, like I said, I don't necessarily think it does a really good job of really stating what Chateau is doing most of the time. Again, people will claim that she's a bounty hunter, and I can go with that. She does do a lot of jobs that are kind of more questionable. She's doing jobs that most people wouldn't do, sort of like an investigator or whatever. And there was a lot of cases where, again, like I said earlier, it seemed like Song would get a hostage, which obviously seemed like it was somebody trying to kill him. But yet somehow we're supposed to believe that Chateau had a job to find that person. It didn't really make sense of exactly what they were doing. Was he just keeping him a hostage after they tried to kill him and then said, hey, I'll give you this hostage? Or did she have a job to find that person? A lot of that stuff didn't really make sense. So like the moment to moment, why Chateau was doing what she was doing never made sense to me, or at least it didn't feel like it was well described. Now, the bigger problem is that early on, it made sense around who was after Chateau in order to get to Song. Obviously, Song was involved with people that were like mafia groups, gangs and stuff like that. Song was involved in somebody and he betrayed them. And so they were trying to get back at him by getting to Chateau. That made sense. But the problem is the later stuff. Once it starts getting into the bigger plot line of this bigger organization that's going to be more significant to the story of Chateau and Song, that's where I felt like I didn't get enough. It literally just kind of introduces a lot of that concept, and then it leaves it on a really nasty cliffhanger. Like, at the end of this show, I felt satisfied around Chateau and Song's story together, because it does get into all that stuff. The problem is the going forward stuff. What they're going to deal with next, which is this organization, it doesn't get to it. It doesn't have enough time, obviously, which I wouldn't mind. The problem is they do the whole thing where suddenly out of nowhere, people are put in danger, and then it says goodbye. That's my problem. You see, it cuts to a random character in the story, and a gun's being held to somebody's head, obviously taken hostage or whatever, and it's like, see you later. Like, it, that's my issue. The manga bait aspect, which I think this show does a little bit of. Thankfully, it's characters I don't really care too much for, but it's still an issue in my mind. It's still that remaining thread that it's trying to purposely hint at and go out of its way to hint at just to pull you into the source material, or possibly can get a second season. I haven't heard of a second season, but that's my issue with the overall story in the end. So I don't know. It's definitely a show that I don't really know if I can suggest or not. If you're looking for a more violent romance, and yes, a romance that is definitely different and very questionable, I think it's a great story. I think it's a great way of really kind of introducing that aspect. At the same time, I have my frustrations with a lot of fake outs. This storyteller loves fake outs. Like, we're going some really stupid fake outs. Like, these are fake outs. I was like, no, that really shouldn't have resolved like that. But sure, I guess if you want to just kind of bait people, I guess you can go with that. It does that a lot, which did frustrate me a bit. And like I said, I technically did want to get a lot more into the later organization they got into, but it never really was fulfilled. So yeah, I don't know. It's like the episode per episode frustration I had was like a mix of, I kind of like this, but at the same time, I don't. And I think it has this writer, maybe it's possibly the writer's credit that they know how to do uncomfortable situations that, yeah, you can kind of see it resolving good or not, but in the end, you also don't really necessarily agree with how it's being handled. It is that aspect of this is somebody that you don't agree with, and that's just how it is. Like, you don't always have to agree with a protagonist. You don't always have to agree with how somebody handles situations, and you can still enjoy a story. It's almost as if you're kind of, with Song, you're almost technically watching the bad guy story, and there is no redeeming aspect of it until you really get deep into the story. And that's the big question mark, whether somebody's going to enjoy it or not. And I can obviously understand the frustration that people would have with that. So I guess my other frustration I have with is obviously Chateau. She's not a bricks character. She's just a broken character, and she does push back when she needs to. And so I don't classify her as a bricks character. And I think she can easily probably be seen as by some people as a bricks character. For those that are not familiar with the bricks comment that we make all the time that we have to explain, essentially a female character who just gets pulled along everywhere. They have no personality, no interest in their own. They just get pulled everywhere by the male character. I don't think she's that. At the same time, I know I had frustration with the idea that she always seems like she's a damsel in distress a lot, which I don't mind damsel in distresses. I don't mind the princess being saved. I just feel like I had some sort of expectation that she was going to be a lot more skilled than she was. And I guess that's my own fault for believing that she is some sort of secret agent. She's not. She's just really somebody that handles jobs, and she gets in overhead. So I don't necessarily think that she has to do cool stuff, but there was times where I kind of was wanting her to do cool stuff, and she didn't really do cool stuff. And that was a little bit of frustration. But again, nothing indicated that she was a secret agent. Nothing indicated that she was a child soldier that should be super skilled. So I think that's a good expectation for people to should know going into it. So,
well, if you go by the aspect of her being a bounty hunter, you would assume that she would be able to hold her own at least.
Not really. It's that you can point a gun and that you serve papers. That's all a bounty hunter really has to do. And when you think that you, well, I mean, if you think about it, in most cases with bounty hunters, most people are just kind of handling basic issues. They're not really going into fighting child soldiers. There's no expectation for a bounty hunter to take down a soldier or whatever. They're taking down common criminals that jump bounty. They're not really people that are assassins and stuff. And so, again, like I said, it kind of is more an aspect of her being in over her head than anything. So, but I agree. Also, Jim's annoying. Jim's really annoying. I never liked Jim. Jim is really, really annoying. It seems like some sort of foreigner character, based on the idea that they overemphasize Japanese dialogue. I always make the joke of Shantou Wakarimasu. It's that kind of a character, and he has no mouth. For some reason, I don't know. Maybe it's probably in the manga as well. Has no mouth. And the entire anime, they have no mouth and no nose. So it's really off-putting, and I really hated their verbal tic. So, yeah, I don't like Jim. but, yeah, Love of Kill or Kodoshi Ai. Check that out if you're interested. Like I said, if you're looking for more dark romance take, it's definitely interesting. Offeretta from Commonplace to World's Strongest Second Season. Or Offeretta Shokugo de Sekai Saikyo Second Season. This one streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Asreed, Studio Mother. Also to note, Studio Mother replaced White Fox, which you can say is a good thing or a bad thing. Source is a light novel. Genres are action, adventure, fantasy. And for those that are not familiar with the first season, essentially follows an entire classroom of students that all get isekai'd into another world. And they're all brought there and kind of being trained by the kingdom there in order to become soldiers to fight against the demon lord. And the kind of twist that happens early on in the show is that Hajime, one of these students, who seems to be kind of deemed by everybody as useless, his power is really useless, he ends up getting pretty much caught in the crossfires purposely to pretty much be killed. And he ends up falling down this really deep labyrinth all the way down the bottom, where he is essentially trying to fight to survive down there with all these beasts and monsters. And eventually, after pretty much nearly dying and hiding away in some little nook, he ends up essentially coming across this power, and it kind of unlocks, and he's able to kind of gain a lot of skills and ability to essentially create. There's a lot of create magic, and he pretty much uses it to pretty much introduce like things from our world, like guns and stuff, into this world in order to use to survive. And he ends up coming across this vampire who was sealed away in this deep labyrinth, and he releases her. And so you kind of had the two of them forming a bond, because they were both technically discarded by people and locked away. And so they kind of find a bond between each other in that aspect, and eventually find Shia, who is a bunny girl, and eventually some crazy dragon chick that likes to be impaled by stuff, likes pain and stuff. She's that kind of person. Eventually, over time, the big, of course, question mark was something like this, and similar to something like, you know, I'm a spider, so what? That element of wondering, that moment which the class finally meets Hajime again and seeing the significant change he's kind of gone through. He does kind of find this interesting. There's like these labyrinths about the world that he's trying to go to in order to find his own way of returning back to home. Obviously, the class is going along with the kingdom and training and fighting the demon lord, whereas Hajime is like a separate faction. He's like, I'm not going to deal with you guys no more. You pretty much try to kill me. I'm going to find my own way home. And he finds that through this whole labyrinth system that he's investigating. So thoughts on second season?
I'm of two minds on this one as well. I do like the general world building in this show. I like the concepts of the disillusionment, the gods, basically game board that these characters are on, and how they all fit into the bigger picture. Hajime, I've always been kind of mixed on him. I like him in some aspects, and in other ways, I absolutely despise him. He is this kind of...
He's brutally honest. I like how brutally honest he was with Kari.
Exactly. He's one of those that is very... because he effectively was disillusioned of the world early, and him going his own way and going into the god's magic and all that stuff, and like Andrew is mentioning, him finding his own way home, he has become very, very cold to everything else, which you can't really blame him, because of the fact that basically his quote unquote friends tried to kill him early on in the show. So it's one of those things that you understand why he does some of the things he does, and then other things you don't understand. Like, his hatred towards his he doesn't really hate her, but how cold he is with the teacher.
Best girl, by the way.
She's absolutely fantastic.
Teacher's character. Best girl.
I don't know that I would call her best girl, but she's a great character. she's one of those that is that stands by pretty much everybody, and at the same time she stands up to Hajime and says, look, you can't do this. This is too far. And he says, you don't understand. This is standing in my way of doing what I need to do. And so it kind of is one of those two brick walls and standing up for your values, and those two values clash. And I love that the storyline ends up forcing that issue. And so I love a lot of these things that is written into the story. But when it comes down to it, it is very, a lot of the storylines are pretty much just to keep the story going. And you feel that in a lot of
storylines are to get the story going. Mind bending.
I know.
You might want to expand on that a little bit, Chris.
I'm trying to, if you didn't go and start making fun of me right away.
Sure.
they're very, simple in a lot of cases.
They are simple,
and that's I probably would say is my biggest frustration there. While I'm grasping onto these kind of more deeper thoughts, like I said with Sensei versus Hajime, and their two visions of what they see as the direction to go end up clashing, that's probably one of the more deeper of the discussions in all. For the most part, because of the fact that they're kept separate for so long, a lot of those path lines or character motivations don't clash very often, because Hajime doesn't interact with the class very often, and vice versa. The class, even with this latter arc where they actually do kind of interact, which was kind of one of the more cooler aspects of these, while they didn't see eye to eye, they ended up going in the same direction because they had to. I did like that they ended up doing that, and they still didn't deviate from the idea of they don't see eye to eye still. I will do it this way, and I have to do it this way because I have to align myself with your motivations. But when it all comes down to in the end, they still don't see eye to eye, even though they had to come together at one point. So there is a lot of really cool things. And then you have the, some characters are, their motivations are way off kilter, and they are, and how they influence the story as a whole. So there is some aspects that I do really like about this show. And I did walk away from this all in all, enjoying the story, as a whole. But when it comes down to it, some characters are hit and some characters are missed. So take that for what it is.
I always had this, I had the same issue with the first season. I had the same issue with the second season. I don't like a lot of the members of the class, because it really does feel like they either go down this really dumb direction that makes no sense, that goes too far, or they're just kind of going with the flow. And I had that struggle with the first season, like I said, and I feel like that kind of transitioned to the second season as well. This whole idea of, like, because Yandere, okay, sure.
Pretty much.
Whatever. It's like, it's a big shrug from me. It's like, and that's a frustrating thing, is like, I surprisingly enjoy the second season. I honestly wanted to get caught up for the sake of I watched the first season, I might as well watch the second season. And I really was kind of just trying to burn through it as fast as possible. But I had a lot of times where I'm like, I really do kind of like this writer. It is what many would call just a trash isekai that you're going to enjoy because it's trash. I don't necessarily agree, because I think it does I think in many ways it does things a lot better than most. Yeah, the biggest comparison you're probably going to give this is something like Shield Hero. It's the idea of the main character who's just jaded by the group that he's brought into. Same with Shield Hero. He's isekai with a bunch of other people. They kind of throw him off to the side. Even to the point where we had at the end of the first season, this idea of the church itself deeming him as being this thing that shouldn't exist. He's too powerful. He shouldn't be in this equation. He needs to be getting rid of. He is the discarded person. And that jadedness that he kind of gets from that is, again, kind of something similar to Shield Hero. And I think obviously with Shield Hero, I love the characters way more. Like, so many of the side characters are so more well-written than this one. I do like this one for, I guess, how it's doing a lot of things different than Shield Hero. Now, I do get frustrated a little bit with Hajime's back and forth. He essentially is the bitter, angry person. And everybody else is just pawns of this thing that I obviously know is not something I want to get involved with. So I'm going to do my own thing over here. That's fine. But it always seems like it's that...
Communication?
It's almost as if they play off the jaded hero too much, and the introduction to the group over and over again to say, you're all doing it wrong, you obviously all are in my way, I'll kill anything in my way. And it's like, okay, dude, you did that before. You already understand what's going on. Why are you still acting as if you need to treat everybody this way? It's almost as if he gets realization points and he calms down, but then he turns back to being the edgelord 2 minutes later. So it's like, chill, dude. What happened to you like 5 minutes ago when you realized that you were kind of going a little too far? Again, I think it plays too much on the reintroduction to the group and being the edgelord, he saves the day kind of thing. The thing I do appreciate is that with this season, going counter to my statement about liking the characters more in Shield Hero, I'm doing the comparison thing like you did earlier. Mm-hmm. How dare me?
it's hard not to do.
But it's a nice comparison, the idea that most people are probably not watching Alpharetta, but they've watched Shield Hero. So it gives you a sense of what you're kind of going to experience. So I guess that's that bonus there. I do like what the writer has done with a lot of this, the quote-unquote harem. Hajime has a harem, obviously. Yue is his first focus because she was the one that was like him, and he made a really strong bond with her, and I really like that.
She saved him in a moment of...
They saved each other.
At the bottom, yeah.
Yeah. But I like how when they introduce... This is the funny thing, is because they introduced Shia, and Shia was just there. Shia has always just been there, and she's always been trying to keep up with them. She's obviously just a bunny girl with a hammer. Tio was introduced again to the harem, but she always had this element of, I just want to be the mistress, harm me, I like it kind of thing. She was always just the joke, BDSM or whatever. Now, the weird thing that happens, they never had like a harem joke thing going on with Hajime, because Yue was the focus, Shio was falling, and Tio just wanted to be the mistress. And then Kaori gets introduced in the second season, and I almost felt angry because, yep, I felt like the moment Kaori showed up with the first part of the second season, well, she technically was introduced with the end of the first season to the party. Suddenly, the writer got way too into his harem. And the reason why I say that's too much into it is it constantly had to remind me that Yue and Kaori were competing. And I kept going, okay, if this is going to be the thing we're going to keep introducing every 2 seconds, I'm going to get annoyed because I don't need to know about the fact that they're competing every 2 seconds. But it was cool that eventually it had this realization, or they had this brutal moment. Hajime likes to speak his mind. Hajime does not hold back. And so it was kind of refreshing to have that moment where Hajime says, do you really want to be a part of this group? Like, Shia, she pushes herself. Tio pushes herself. Everybody in my party is pushing themselves, but you're too damn focused on me. Like, I keep looking to you and you're just looking at me. Are you gonna help, or are you gonna? And it was one of those moments of like, you kind of have this feeling of like, Kaori, are you really even doing anything besides whimpering at him? Like, are you gonna do anything? And it has that moment where it says, this isn't just a harem, this is my party. Are you going to be a part of that group, or are you just going to sit there and whimper at me all the time? Are you just going to be a dumb female character in my harem? Like, like I said, it's almost the writer acknowledging it, like saying, no, I'm not doing the whole harem thing. He's got a focus and she's technically sidetracking him. And now I'm going to have the character acknowledge that. And again, that was that moment where I'm like, here's a typical harem. Oh, wow. The writer's actually going to go this far. And I actually liked it. I actually like the fact that it was almost a slap in the face of this idea of just being a harem. Like, Kaoru at that point wasn't just an introduced harem character. It was a plot point that I thought was really cool. And then kind of interjecting some aspect of that later on. But yeah, outside of that, like I said, my main frustrations that I've had with this show has always kind of been around the rest of the class, where I think it's a cool idea of having the jaded classmate that gets separated in the isekai. but I feel like it never really does enough with the other characters. Even though it keeps showing them, it never does enough with them that I feel is satisfying. It just feels like they're always there to basically show how much Hajime has progressed. There to be manipulated so that Hajime can come in and say, I'm better than you all. And I think that's where a lot of my frustration goes. I agree with you. I'd like the teacher. Because I think the thing that she always is she is... I guess the reason why I like the teacher is she's always the thing to really show Hajime where he's gone and where he is. Whereas everybody else is just there to see. The classmates are the observers. The teacher is the one to really point it out. And so it makes it... With her being the one that points it out, it makes the rest of the class just useless. They're just literally the side characters in the Dragon Ball Z fight that go, they just use the Hamehameha again. Like, I know that. I see it. I don't need the classmates to show it. I know what Hajime is doing. I don't need them to tell me what they're doing. And that's the frustration that comes. And I guess I feel the overall plot line's not really there for me anymore. Like, it was kind of interesting when they first introduced the idea of the labyrinth being another way that Hajime can get home. His not wanting to be involved with what essentially everybody's getting caught up in. And I just felt like all we got with this season was just them pointing out more. Like, yes, they're all pawns in something, and Hajime doesn't want to be involved in it. So I feel like with the demons and the gods and all that kind of stuff that's kind of being continuously got into with the second season, I wasn't really interested in because I didn't feel it's that fascinating.
The demons were very, very disappointing. They did well in the first season. I want revenge because girlfriend was kind of annoying.
That was literally the end of the first season. So that's be the second season.
No, yeah. Well, her dying, the second season was the revenge.
Yeah.
The aspect of the Valkyrie was interesting.
I got a kick. I was like, they're gonna totally get her in the harem, aren't they? And yeah. I'm like, okay,
it went a slight different way. They pulled it off.
I was like, I was so curious how they were gonna rope her in. I'm like, I guess you could do that. Sure.
Yeah, I liked that. Because I thought the same thing. They're gonna drag her into the harem. It's funny because it's like. Like I said, there is aspects that I do like about it, and I do, but I have to agree, the formulaic nature of the, and it seems like they're going faster through the labyrinths. They're not really digging into
like,
the labyrinth.
The last labyrinth was literally, you've done everything, by the way, so you're done. I was like, what? Like he had a bullet point check marks, or these checkpoints that he had to do, and he just shows up and it says, oh, you did them all. Okay. I literally thought one of the checkpoints was going to turn out to be like, you know, shoot your girlfriend because that's completely random. Anyway, sorry.
And that's the thing is there's some things that I want in some cases, I want the class to be more involved. And maybe that's something that's going to come in the future. Seeing as how where they left us off at the end of this, the last episode, that it felt like maybe some of these other characters are going to be involved more. And then in other respects, I do like the fact that he in himself, while he is growing as a character, he's not growing as a person. And that's another aspect that is kind of frustrating. Now, you do see a lot of the characters around him seem to be growing as people, for a lack of a better term. So it's six in one hand and half dozen in the other. He needs to grow. He himself needs to grow. And maybe it's a frustration of the writer because of the fact that he made him grow too much at the beginning. And so now I don't know how to write him as a person. And it's frustrating.
It is him basically refining himself and refining humanity. Yeah, that's kind of been a core thing. And I think, again, the teacher has a lot to do with that. And that's kind of become her goal. I got sidetracked, but I was going to get into it. I do like the fact that with the second season, it really does feel like his quote-unquote harem is growing. Like, they are getting stronger. I don't like the idea of a Kirito aspect where just it's a bunch of cute girls following him around, and they never really add anything but maybe shield one spell here or there. It really feels like Yue has always felt really OP. Like, she has always been, like, literally almost his equal. But it always felt like Shia and Tio were just there with the first season. And I really do feel like in the second season, it's like Shia got stronger. Again, playing back onto what Hajime said to Kaori. Shia was really weak. She could never keep up to us. And the moment he kind of points that out, it kind of shows how Shia is getting stronger. She's actually a force to be reckoned with. She's finding ways to become a part of the group and be their equal. And again, Tio is technically the same way. He trusts her because he knows Tio is strong. And I like that aspect that it points that out. And again, technically it points it out with Kaori and how they what they do with her in the later part of the season. So I do like that. I like that it's not just they're there to look cute and they're always being saved by him and they're always going, oh my gosh, Hajime did something incredible. The writer is actually making them be a part of his party. And I'm curious, and that's one of the things that kind of gets me excited for a possible third season is that it seems like it wants to hint at them, him doing that with everybody else.
Right.
And that would be cool because, again, I feel like the rest of the class is extremely unimportant.
They've have at least two more harem member possibilities that need to be hurry up and get involved.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah.
Three.
Oh, I forgot. Teacher's not best girl. It's Mew's mom. Did you like the inclusion of the ho-ho-ho girl?
Oh. Yeah, they probably know. Oh. She's great. I forgot about that. So four harem members. Yeah,
she was definitely an Adada character.
Adada.
She was like perfectly fine. Like, oh yeah, you're definitely Papa. You want to get Papa needs to come back. Yeah, it was. Yeah, there you go. So yeah, I guess it's like one of those aspects. Like I said, I do like a lot of things it does. I honestly came in the second season really kind of wanting to skim through it for the sake of watching it. And I did find a lot of things in here that I felt was extremely improved from the first season. I just think this writer is still failing at a lot of things. And I hope that it kind of improves as it goes along. So, Alpharetta, season two. Princess Connect Redive, second season or season two. This one was streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes. Season one was back in 2020. So it's been a couple of years, but still. Studio is Cygame Pictures. Source is a game. The genres are action, adventure, fantasy. Director was Takaomi Kanasaki, who did Konosuba and Tokyo Ravens. The creator is Cygames. It's a Cygames properties. Obviously, this is based off of a mobile game. Cygames obviously has done Rage of Bahamut and Grand Blue Fantasy. But yeah, this one essentially, for those that not watched the first season, essentially opens up following a boy who appears out of nowhere named Yuki. Of course, he quickly meets Kokoro, who apparently was told that he would essentially be there. She got a prophecy that, you know, she'd have to come there and become his guide. Later on, they end up bumping into Pekarin, who seems to have some sort of connection with the royal family, and Karu, who is this girl that seems to be spying on Pekarin and the group for this current leadership of the actual kingdom. So. And as they go along, they decide that they want to open up a gourmet guild because Pekarin really likes to eat food and likes to eat food together with people. So they decide to form a gourmet guild where they do different adventures. They help people with quests, but they also seek out to find the best spices and foods out there in order to eat together and have fun. So, and as it gets into the second season, it kind of gets a lot more focused in on Pekarin, her whole situation with the royal family, Karu, and again her spying on them, and yes, learning more about Yuki and what the heck is Yuki, because he at first was just an amnesiac character, but there's obviously a story behind him. So besides him getting attacked by cracked out wolves all the time, so your thoughts on second season?
There is quite a few episodes where I was going through this. Well, I just a lot of moments where I just got lost in the animation. They went nuts on making the show look as fantastic as possible. And I absolutely love that about this story or this show. Another thing that I did find absolutely fascinating is when they started pulling everything together, because one of the in the first season, you go into watching a lot of this, and you tended to get the obvious feel that there is this is a gacha game, and it almost had this kind of formulaic system of every episode you're introduced to another quote unquote guild, and that guild is about three or four new characters that are involved with with the gotcha system. And it you very quickly get the impression that, yeah, this is a gotcha game that they've turned into the anime. In the second season, it still kind of does that, but at least it starts to feel like they're pulling everything together for an ultimate goal of telling this final story, then getting together to say, this is what's really going on. And I do really like that when everything came together, it felt really epic. They really did drag everything together, say, this is what we're doing, and then give you this really great payoff. I one of the best kind of things that I do remember walking away from this season deciding was there needs to be a law that Pecorin is never allowed to cry ever again, because I kid you not, watching that girl cry absolutely pulled the tears out of my eyes. That was really, really a frustrating scene. Carol too. I mean, but at least not near, because Pecorin is this kind of ganky, you know, fun character. And yeah, getting that out of her was kind of rough, but yeah, it's great payoff.
It's under the Renge clause. You know, Renge in the Renge cry, it's underneath there. And also Pecorin and most Genkis.
Yeah, it, all said and done, fantastic payoff. I got this really great scene. I would hope that you agree, but that underground fight was fantastic. I was busting up laughing. That all these great crazy characters just coming together in this no holds barred battle royale between all the crazy characters. It was great. I loved it.
Yeah. The thing that I always kind of mention with this series, obviously, again, being based off of a mobile game, did definitely put a huge damper on it when it had its first season. But we were technically chiming on people with that first season in 2020 was like, go watch this show. This show is so great. It doesn't matter that it's based off a mobile game. Yes, it has a lot of characters and it's obviously showing them off to sell banners, but these characters are fantastic. And the writing is solid. And then mix into that having Cygames Pictures, which is a studio that literally is the company, and they pump tons of money into it. And it really does feel like Cygames Pictures is trying to be the next Ufotable. Like, it's saying, we can do this too. Watch us go. And second season, they went crazy with it. Second season, like, there was so... Usually, typically, you'll have, like, maybe the first episode's, like, super hyper-animated, or maybe the last battle is going to be hyper-animated. It's like, no, like, out of nowhere, episode 4 is doing crazy stuff, and it's like, what are we doing? But the first season, the big draw was the comedy writing and the timing. Again, I always mention the idea that Konosuba's director... We all know Konosuba is one of the greatest comedies of all time, and a lot of that to do is with timing and just great writing and just basically putting emphasis on some crazy, goofy reactions. Kyaru faces are great. And yes, Kokoro doing the X face. This group knows how to create really funny moments. And that first season was hilarious. I cannot tell you how many times I busted up laughing watching You Could Get Dragged Away by a Pack of Cracked Out Wolves. The second season. This is the thing I want to emphasize with the second season. I will say the comedy took a back seat. It's like the comedy just got pushed back and really toned down. Yes, there's a lot of really funny moments. A lot of them are really in the earlier section, like the first, I don't know, quarter or a third of the show was going back into the comedy. And it seems like all that took the back seat to really start getting into the characters. It's getting these more serious moments to really dive into the mechanics of the world. What are the shadows? Who is Kaiser? Getting into Yuki, getting into Kyaru and Pecorin. That was the focus that it kind of shifted to. So while I will say it wasn't as funny a season, which is kind of a letdown for me because I really loved the comedy in the first season, what I will say is that I got the answers that I wanted and I got the character moments that I wanted. Because I think what it does is you have that whole first season and partially the second season, getting to know the characters, introducing all these guilds. Yes, the Kohai Guild, getting into the Edgelord Guild, getting into the Researchers Guild, the Idols That Have to Fight Guild. All this stuff was kind of for a reason. But obviously, most importantly, and yes, more so in the second season, getting into the relationship of Cotter and Pecotter, which I completely ship. Let's go on full on Yuri. Let's go on full on Yuri ship of Cotter and Pecotter. I want them two to be together and happy and eat cute and eat yummy foods for the rest of their lives. But again, getting into also Yuki, which honestly, Yuki, I kind of assumed that was the case. It wasn't a big shock to me. It was very obvious from the flashbacks he was getting, but it was fine. I still enjoyed it because I seen the struggle that a lot of people were involved with him in his story. A lot of them struggling to really give him what he wanted, which I did like. It's like it's an obvious story. It's not a mind-blowing story, but at the same time, the moment that it was introduced and the people that they're struggling with what is involved was the payoff. And then again, I think Kyaru and Pekarin's story at the later part was I got emotional with that, a lot of that stuff. Seeing the two of them struggling with what they were facing with was a huge struggle for me. And obviously what Kyaru was struggling with outside of Pekarin obviously was a big struggle for her as well. And then adding to that some really incredible animations to tell all that story was what sold it. Like, it's literally, it just takes off with the animation, it takes off with the storytelling, it takes off with all the loose ends that it needs to tell to finish up the story, which I think was wrapped up really well. So, all that stuff is great. But yes, I will admit, I'm a little bit disappointed of how much the comedy got toned down because of that. But it's still a payoff in the end. Especially because it looks so incredibly good, and all the characters are so fantastic. Every guild and group that they introduce is so much fun. And I will, before I forget, can we acknowledge the fact that they animated an idol group? They weren't CGI. Like, I was blown away getting a full idol group performance, and none of it was CGI. I was just like, look, see, they can do it. Look, they can do it. You guys can too. Do it.
They pulled off a lot of the CGI, and they hit it well. So it's one of those that you look at it and you go, I think that's CGI, but they did really well with it. So props that they actually pulled that off in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going off of what you were mentioning about the comedy taking a back seat. It's one of those that, for lack of a better term, they just had so much on the drama beats that they were trying to pack into this storyline that to me, it felt like that's a lot of the case. They just didn't have time to be frivolous with a lot of the comedy. There was still, it felt like, comedy bits that were tossed in here and there, but it felt like they just had so much that of the storyline that they wanted to get packed in there that they just really didn't have time for it.
And I think, and I'm fine with it because I feel like that would just kind of break the mood, yeah. Honestly. I kind of feel like a lot of the first season and additionally some of the segments of the second season was really kind of just those, it almost feels like those side stories that they would introduce with the introduction of a banner. Like, oh, here's the Kohai group. We'll have an event around the Kohai group. And it feels like it's that story. It's really fun. It's goofy. But then, like, this whole second season is, like, getting into that main storyline of the mobile game. Like, this is the core story that we're now going to tell, which is more serious. That's kind of where I was kind of chopping it up as. But, and like I said, I feel like it's a good thing because it separates it so that it doesn't feel jarring. But again, like you said, even though they are kind of side characters and they feel like they're just banner characters, they are a part of the main storyline. So when it does get really serious and it does get into that main core story, they're all technically involved in some way. Like the underground fight is like literally taking all these characters that I thought I would never really see again. Because again, my mind's in mobile game. So I'm assuming, okay, characters like Eriko are never going to get involved again because we got her story and they got their banner out of the way. No, they're involved and they're a part of the story and they suddenly they become key players. It's not just Yuki, Kataro, Pekarin, and Kokoro fighting for the good of everybody. Everybody is involved in some way, and it fits to their character why they're involved in some way. So it's good stuff. It's one of those things that's it's just like Rage of Bahamut was. Rage of Bahamut is not the sum of the mobile game. They did something really incredible with that, minus the second season. And this is the same way. It's just like the Fate Go series. Fate Go series has some incredible writing, despite the fact that it is a mobile game that's selling you on characters and banners. It's not just the sum of that, because they actually have some talented writers actually working to sell you on the content. So it's good stuff. I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I love Princess Connect. I will always love it. Catter's best girl. Just saying. The strongest sage with the Rika's crest, or Shikakumon no Saikyo Kinja. This one's streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio JC staff. Sources light novel. Genres are action, adventure, fantasy. Director is Noriaki Akitaya, who did Castle and Dandelion, Active Raid, Are the Only One That Loves Me. Series composition by Hiroki Uchida, who did Mark Storia and Gamers. So, you did watch this, right?
Yep.
Okay. Making sure before I get started with the synopsis, because I don't really want to do the synopsis again. Basically, a guy who has meet his peak and getting stronger, and so he decides to reincarnate himself several years later to get a new crest. And he gets this new crest, but the world's kind of weird because now everybody believes this crest that he got or born with this time is the weakest crest, hence the name of the actual title. And everybody thinks stupidly because it seems like the demons have kind of corrupted the society of humans to make them weaker by making them believe that they have to basically do incantations for spells. And what was the other stuff that they fool them into thinking was
the fourth crest for whatever reason is the weakest crest, which apparently he says is the strongest crest.
Yeah.
It's
and so he's basically trying to figure out where the demons are at within the academies and stuff and protect the kingdom and get stronger as always. And then he gets obviously a harem that helps him with
stop digging into the dungeons because apparently
he gets the access to the dungeons that have sources. Yeah, that's right, because they locked them up because they didn't feel they were necessary anymore, and he's like, but you need that stuff in there. The materials in there literally are good for like barriers and stuff. The humans in this world are dumb.
This show is absolutely a victim of its flaws, and you will
dude, I'll let you finish. I'm not going to say anything.
It is. It's one of those. I liked it generally because it's just a goofy, you know, kind of popcorn type show. I mean, I didn't hate it when it comes down to it. But it is so fun to make fun of this story. It is like Andrew's saying. I mean, it is. The king is just like, sure, why not? I'll give you all the stuff.
Yeah, the joke that we had was like early, and this is something Chris pointed out in the first impressions, and I'm like, you just made me not like the show even more. It was like I kept making fun of the idea that like, yeah, they somehow managed to, the demons somehow managed to convince everybody that if you actually have to say out your spell, your incantation to cast the spell, it's better than just casting the spell instantly. And he's trying to tell him, like, no, you can do that without saying the incantation. They're like, well, you're special. They're like, no, everybody can do this. It doesn't make any sense. And then, yeah, getting into the other stuff with, like, the weakest crest and everything. And it's like, how did the demons manage to tell these people something so stupid is true? And then you have the moment where, yes, Matthias, the main character, takes down this demon that's infiltrating this other academy. And then he goes before the king, and the king's like, I'll give you full access to the army. Protect us from the demons. Oh, by the way, you want the dungeons? Have the dungeons. We just had them all locked in. I'm like, and then, yeah, Chris pointed out, well, now you understand why the demons were able to talk everybody into that. Now the king literally gave him full control over the protection of the future of the kingdom. He didn't say, Matthias, thanks for saving everybody. And then let's increase our guard. Let's find out where the demons are at and take them down. No, he says, Maddie, what should we do? Like, the king literally just gave this kid full ring of the kingdom. Like, anyways, sorry.
That's the thing.
It's absurd. And you can find fun in that.
I had more fun making fun of this show than anything else. I think that's one of the absolute charms of this show is making fun of it. I do like the characters. Matthias, for all of my making fun of him, he's actually pretty cool. The girls are fun. Iris is absolutely just a treat. I love the kind of her just being overpowered and oops, just because she is. But yeah, generally, I enjoyed myself watching the show, but I give you all the caution in the world. There is some absolute, like Andrew had said, big absurdities in here that you're just going, Sure, why not? Because Matthias is just that awesome. He ends up running into I was trying to remember who the voice actor. I don't think it was Kendro Suda, but it was another one of the big name male voice actors, and he just, I think it was Ronta. And he absolutely pulled off this character, not in the annoying way,
not in the Ronta way.
Yeah, not in the Ronta way. You know, he has this other character, another character that he plays that is kind of really pulls off this this kind of cool devil may care type character that he just really pulls off, and he did that type of character in this. And he, Matthias was fighting against him, and he was, it kind of was an extension of the whole, you don't have to actually cast. He was a character who, due to him doing a lot of physical, fighting, he ended up, inherently casting the spells automatically. And it was a kind of a cool little twist on the not having to, use the, incantations to do the spells. And Matthias said, no, you don't understand. You may possibly surpass me at my level right now if you learn these spells. And he said, well, but I have to read. So it was great. But yeah, there's a lot of kind of little cool things that are embedded in the world that are neat, but they kind of get kind of lost in the aspects of the, well, because Matthias is cool, overpowered character, we got to give everything to him. So yeah,
that's kind of why I didn't really go back to it. Is I just got really tired of Matthias as a character. I felt like he was just very it was a struggle watching him as he was kind of being thrown off by girls, and it's like, this guy has lived how long and he doesn't know how to even communicate with girls. I mean, yeah, you can chop that up as him being, like, so isolated in his attempts to getting stronger in his previous life that he never interacted with girls, but it's like, really? Really? Like, you still are of a mature mind. Like, you grow up, and you mature. You hit puberty and stuff like that. But that was a little bit of a struggle with me. But, yeah, I like that it felt like, and this you can confirm or deny if this is something that continues, I like that it wasn't just about him being overpowered, but he was trying to help, yes, the entire kingdom get stronger, but a lot of focus on party building, which I've always kind of enjoy with things like Death March, this idea of kind of, it's not just about him being overpowered. He's kind of trying to teach his other party members how to be strong, because for some reason he thinks that he has to have a party to go in dungeons, which I don't know why, you're overpowered. He was trying to help them because he wanted a party to go down the dungeons. And I did like that it was kind of showing them how to do it. But then it also kind of turned into one of those things where it had to explain things every 2 seconds. And I'm like, yeah, I gather what happened. You don't have to explain what just happened. But
he does rely on them more, ish. That's about all I can say.
I mean, that was a similar thing with Afureta. I like this idea of them just not being the Kirito side harem characters that just stand there and look cute, but they're actually part of the fight. So, yeah.
Anyway. It all comes down to, in every situation, yeah, he relies on them more and more, but when it comes down to it, Big Demon, he's the one fighting it. So, and they're out going and capturing whatever it was that he needed for that battle. I'm not going to go into that.
So how light novels baity is it? Or do you think it's going to get a second season? It'll probably get a second season. What am I talking about?
Yeah, probably. But it did feel like it came to a good solid chapter conclusion. Just ending a battle and saying,
so he got the crown.
No.
So he got the crown from the king somehow.
Might as well have.
He has a big battle. He comes back in there and the king's like,
no, they fast tracked him through the college. So I don't even know why he went to the college in the first place, but they fast tracked him through it and gave him special permission. And they actually did this well with something that actually was kind of thought of. Is they fast-tracked him through and said, you have special permission to go from place to place doing your quests as an honorable honorary member of our college because it will make us look good the more and more you do, because we, but there's nothing else that we can teach you. So it was kind of one of those things that was kind of cool that they actually thought to do that. Instead of just saying, you're already master, go do your thing. They actually said, no, we're doing this because we have nothing more to teach you, and it will look good. It, the more and more you do, it'll look good upon us as an academy that you came from us. And I thought that was kind of a cool thing that they thought
of. So he's a walking billboard.
Yep, pretty much.
Good for you, Matthias. Anyways, that's the strongest sage with the weakest crest. Check that out if that sounds to you. Definitely.
I do wish they had gotten into the crest thing a little bit more. I really do. I mean, they kind of implied, okay, that the... It's almost one of those that they kind of implied that the fourth crest was had something to do with rapid fire, basically, and more. And it's only good if you can do kind of hand-to-hand combat, but they never really dug into it. What is the first crest? What is the second crest? This is obviously the fourth crest, so get into all those so that we understand why the fourth crest is the best one.
Yeah, I know at some point they had, was it Matthias asked Lurie to basically dive through each of them, but I don't think they covered the last one, yeah. She, like, explained each one of them, and, but again, that was a whole aspect of, like, okay, we just got, went over the idea that the demons are telling them stupid stuff in order for them to be stupid so that they can get taken over. Is what she's saying right now even true? I mean, he technically does point out, like, one of them, like, no, that's technically not true, so they were kind of, again... spreading false propaganda within the kingdom. So, but yeah, that was kind of an interesting element that they kind of had in there. I think that they also had some of it was explained in like the aftercast stuff, like these little goofy little skits. But anyways, yeah, that's all the shows for the winter 2022 anime season. It's time to get started with the spring season. So
thank you.
Yay. And thankfully let's all take a moment to say goodbye to Funimation. This is our official goodbye to Funimation. They will apparently not have any of the next season within Funimation's platform. So I was kind of happy after struggling with getting through Offerta on the app, and it kept not showing me all the episodes. So I won't miss it in that regard. So goodbye, Funimation. Hello, Crunchyroll rules all. Well, there's High Dive too, so they're doing pretty decently well. So. Yeah, our job does not end right into the next season, but we hope you guys enjoyed our run through.
Now I have to catch up on this season.
Yep, you're behind a whole episode of all the shows. Well, three episodes of Esta. That's already gotten like Esta Life or whatever has like four episodes already. So, anyways, that we'll get to that. We hope you all enjoyed this episode. Thank you all for listening, and y'all take care.
Os. Thank you.